Coming up on Tech Nation, Brad Stone from Bloomberg News. He's talking about the upstarts, how Uber, Airbnb, and the killer companies of the new Silicon Valley are changing the world. Then on Tech Nation Health, integrating the data from all our smartphone apps and exercise bands, medical devices, and even clinical trials. Drew Schiller says Validic started simple. And remember, every nation approves drugs, medical devices, and even cosmetics differently. Greer Deal from Global Regulatory Services breaks it down. All this coming up on this week's Tech Nation.
Let's take five with Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Whether we're talking about skyrocketing healthcare costs or burdensome health insurance payments, as everyone knows, even with insurance, in the event that you have an emergency or a condition of significance, your share of the financial bill is substantial. So what does this mean? Well, what you're looking at is, wait for it, success. It sure doesn't feel that way when you're looking at the bill, but this kind of experience is what happens when innovation produces. That's right, new innovation, often developed under the mantra of R&D, the convenient initials for research and development, and hidden just below the surface in startups and pipelines inside large companies. Well, all of this scientific and technological innovation in the healthcare field is producing more and more every day. This means that innovation has momentum, and the ability to further innovate expands even more. People always ask me, why doesn't faster, better, cheaper happen with healthcare costs? Well, actually, it does. But the significant costs that you are seeing are the part which is brand new innovation. When it's new, it's at its highest cost and therefore highest price. Better, faster, cheaper only returns palpable dividends when the product doesn't change. Now, better, faster, cheaper has without a doubt contributed to innovation. When the underlying computing product, including the software, built in a building block, plug-and-play fashion, can be had for pennies, then it's only the new innovation on top of that that you're paying for. You want affordable health care? Next time, insist to your doctor and hospital that you only want procedures and tests and drugs that were available 20 years ago. Now, 20 years ago, that technology was pretty cool. It was the latest and greatest then. But now, who goes in and asks for old technology? In fact, we assert it would be inhumane to not offer the very best technology to everyone. And I agree. But the problem is, our ways for paying for all this has been outpaced by our ability to innovate new products. And the current economic model? Well, it's just not up to the task. For one thing, we have to understand that the laws of economics are man-made. It's not like, say, the law of gravity. Jump out a second-story window, and in no time at all, you've landed on the ground. Economic systems must be very carefully built, and they only ever work for so long, often spun out of kilter by new technological innovation. Remember guns and butter? In that case, sailing ships took months to bring guns one way and butter the other, crossing back and forth between England and the colonies. We could see the simple trade slowed down because it was slow. Add in the southern colonies and the slave trade. These ships didn't just drop off the slaves and head back to Africa with an empty load. Economic systems that work need to work systemically. And any system where parts of it can change fast and dramatically, well, they just can't be expected to work year after year. And so we must rethink the economics of what we're doing here. Trying to change health insurance as a fix as to how we're going to solve the cost of health care? It's like trying to fix an entire chair, but we can only make adjustments to the same one of its legs. Paying for health care while embracing these new innovations, this is going to require some serious thought. I'm Moira Gunn. This is 5 Minutes.
Five Minutes is produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. 5 Minutes is a production of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancourt.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, the Bloomberg News Senior Executive Editor of Global Technology, Brad Stone. His new book, The Upstarts, explains why Uber and Airbnb are so successful and the rules that they challenge to do it. Then on Tech Nation Health, integrating the information from all our smartphone apps and exercise bands right up to new medical devices and doing clinical trials remotely. And getting it all approved? Where in every nation's regulations are different? We'll hear from Greer Deal, the Director of Global Regulatory Services. Brad Stone has been on TechNation before, starting with 2003's Gearheads. Now he's here with The Upstarts, how Uber, Airbnb, and the killer companies of the new Silicon Valley are changing the world. Well, Brad, welcome back to TechNation.
Thank you, Moira.
The subtitle to your book suggests that there's a new Silicon Valley. A new one?
Well, in some respects, I do feel like this is a community that does reinvent itself every, let's just say for the sake of argument, 7 to 8 years. You know, we had 1993 to 2000, the first boom, 2001 to 2008, a quieter period marked by the emergence of Facebook and the global recession. And then 2009 to today, where, you know, a great boom, an influx of capital from non-traditional sources, and emerging from that maelstrom, Uber and Airbnb and some other companies that have arguably made a huge impact.
Well, the other part of your subtitle that I like is the term killer companies. Now, we used to have killer apps. Now we have killer companies.
And it's a different kind of killer, right? It's almost literal because these companies have disrupted industries, put some old stakeholders out of business, you know, roiled cities and regulators and communities. And so, you know, have really challenged a set of assumptions and left a fair amount of chaos and controversy in their wake.
Certainly the two most well-known and palpably disruptive companies are Uber and Airbnb, and you interweave them throughout the book. Recently, many people learned the name of the CEO of Uber, Travis Kalanick. Did I pronounce
yes,
that correctly?
Yes, I believe that was
Kalanick.
Correct.
Remind people why he was in the news recently.
Well, I mean, to anyone who's been paying attention, you know, I think Travis has been, you know, he's pretty well known. You know, he's one of the co-founders and the longtime CEO of Uber, which, you know, has spread around the world very quickly and has grown to over 11,000 employees in just a short number of years. And in the process, perhaps is not, you know, professionalized to the extent that it should have. And so there have been a rolling series of controversies that you're alluding to. You know, one case, the company was the subject of a sexual harassment lawsuit by a female employee. There was a video that my colleagues at Bloomberg that we posted where Travis was caught in a dashboard camera arguing with the driver who had accosted him and was complaining about driver earnings. There's a lawsuit between Google and Uber over intellectual property, and we can go on. There are more Uber conflicts. But these are the things that have propelled Travis into the limelight once again, and he has now said – he has kind of fallen on his sword and said he needs leadership help running Uber.
We're hiring a consultant. Everything will be just fine. Personal coach.
Exactly.
Personal coach.
And a COO. He thinks he needs a running partner to develop the company.
Got it. Got it. Now, the other one is Airbnb. In the news a lot, in a lot of countries, a lot of cities, but fewer people have heard about everyday people. Fewer people have heard of its CEO, Brian Chesky.
Right. He is one of the three Airbnb co-founders. He started this company out of his home here in San Francisco at the end of 2007. He has, you know, steered the company to become, in a very short amount of time, a global franchise. It is worth more than $31 billion. It is targeting an IPO for next year. But at the same time, not without its own little salting of controversy. There are lots of cities that wonder how much of Airbnb is a good thing. Do you start taking properties off the rental market or the housing market if you're making them available to tourists? How does it impact the word that we are all obsessing over these days, affordability, if suddenly our homes and our neighborhoods are thrown up into tourists? And so
neighborhoods, are you going to see somebody coming in and out constantly next door?
It's it's good if they're going to spend money at the local restaurant or the coffee shop. That's a positive. If they're fumbling with the keys at 2 a.m. and they're and the apartment is down the hallway from you, maybe that's not such a good thing. So there's a trade-off, and Chesky and his crew have had to walk the fine line between touting the benefits of Airbnb, and there are remarkable benefits, with assuaging communities on the drawbacks, those externalities that make people feel a little bit uncomfortable.
Before we get any further with this, let's remind everybody about the business models for Uber and for Airbnb, because they actually couldn't exist until we had smartphones, and a lot of people had smartphones. And some of that technology, GPS and all that stuff, all was developed and very simply accessible and understood. So let's talk about the two different business models, how they're similar and how they're different.
Right. And in fact, on the cover of the book is an image of a wave. And I play with that image throughout the book. Both of these companies, even though they are ingenious inventions, they were really carried on a wave of other things, of underlying platform shifts. So both companies are kind of remarkable business models because they own no physical assets. Uber owns no cars. Airbnb owns no hotel rooms. It doesn't have to clean anything in the morning. Hosts are responsible for that. And both companies take a commission on the exchange, Uber for brokering a relationship between a rider and a driver. There's usually around a 30% commission there, with some fees baked in, and Airbnb as well takes a percentage of the transaction fee, collects it right after the guest books, and then pays the host after the stay is complete. So, both companies in some ways sort of, mirroring Amazon in terms of like the cash that they generate, the flexibility that they have with their cash. Of course, both much more asset light than Amazon. And both companies have just funneled, I think, are fundamentally most likely profitable, but have funneled those profits into growing the business, growing internationally, going into new product areas.
You start everyone at the same physical geographic location. So even though they're already started, you took both sets of startup guys, the original, we'll call them teams, whether they get along or not. They both happen to go to Obama's 2009 inauguration, albeit in different circumstances.
Right. Well, I was worried when I decided to combine these stories that they would feel like two different books kind of mashed together. But as I was reporting it, it was interesting to me how many points of overlap there were. I mean, the CEOs would go to dinner. They learned a lot from each other. They had similar regulatory challenges that they handled differently. But, at some point I realized, wow, both of these sets of founders, when they were anonymous and struggling, were kicking around at the first inauguration of President Obama. What a great place to start this book, because, in fact, all this stuff has happened in the span of one presidential administration. And so, the Airbnb guys, they had a WordPress site, airbedandbreakfast.com. They were passing out flyers at the DuPont
Flyers.
Metro station.
How 1960s.
Yeah, very
flyers.
Humble beginnings.
Rent your room.
Yep. They were freezing in the mall as Obama went and took the oath of office. The two Uber founders, Travis Kalanick and Garrett Camp, this was pre-Uber, but Garrett had the idea. And as they were running down, they were late to the inauguration. So as they were running through the frigid cold trying to get there in time, Garrett was pitching Travis on the idea for what was then called Uber Cab. And I just thought, you know, there was a nice parallel. Like, here they are, two sets of founders, totally anonymous, still struggling, but in a very short amount of time, they would reveal themselves to the world.
And they all flew all the way from California to Washington, D.C. to see the inauguration.
And if I'm honest, I thought that I would be ending the book with the inauguration of President Clinton, and that, I also thought there was a chance that maybe the founders would be returning for another inauguration.
Rats,
and that's not
huh?
how things happened. But it's still, you know, like the book has bookends, and these are two different presidents coming to office.
You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Brad Stone, the senior executive editor of global technology at Bloomberg News. You may well know him as the author of 2003's Gearheads, The Turbulent Rise of Robotic Sports, and more recently, The Everything Store, Jeff Bezos and the Age of Amazon. He's back with The Upstarts, How Uber, Airbnb, and the Killer Companies of the New Silicon Valley Are Changing the World. Let's just fast forward now. You mentioned Airbnb is valued at $31 billion, more than any hotel chain in the world. Get that in your
actually,
head.
Actually, close. Marriott recently bought Starwood. It's up there.
Oh.
But there has to be consolidation now for any hotel company to get in the realm of Airbnb.
And Uber doesn't own anything.
That's right.
No hassles.
Right.
No
and
hassles.
They're, and they're at $69 billion, which for some people seems like there's nowhere to go but down.
Right. Right. But they're both private companies. They're not publicly traded. I mean, that's just an enormous accomplishment.
Well, it's a sign of the times. A lot of things have happened since the financial crisis to make it easier. Well, to make it harder for companies to go public, more demands on transparency and kind of incentivizing companies to stay private longer. And as a result, there have been opportunities for new sources of capital, the sovereign wealth funds, the hedge funds or mutual funds to come in and invest in some of these very late stage private Silicon Valley startups. So, yes, it's an accomplishment that both companies have grown as gone as far as they have as private, but it's also a symptom of like at really unusual times. And perhaps that we'll see the spectrum moving backward because, you know, I would imagine that both of those companies, you have employees and early investors that really probably want to see some liquidity.
And it's all on paper.
That's right. So, you know, you've got, I would say right now, Silicon Valley, it has its wealth completely tied up in these two companies and is waiting probably pretty impatiently for some IPOs.
Interesting as well is that they all went global and how they all went global. That's a sign of the times, too.
And they had to do it. Their hands were forced. And I think Airbnb was maybe a little more passive. In 2011, they saw these very accomplished German entrepreneurs, the Sammer brothers, who are quite capable at cloning Silicon Valley companies and pursuing the opportunity even faster and then kind of maneuvering a merger. And when the Sammers started an Airbnb clone, you know, Brian Chesky at Airbnb had to globalize the company very quickly. And they suddenly, you know, started adding in employees and opening offices, and they did manage to kind of beat the Sammers back. At Uber, Travis had a little more foresight around the international opportunity. Paris, I think, was like their fourth or fifth city. And he went perhaps a little haphazardly into places like China and India, where there is, of course, very strong local competition. In China, they had to retreat. In India, they're in a pretty high-stakes battle right now. So, you know, yeah, both of these companies, I think, saw that their sort of manifest destiny was to become international platforms.
I'd like to return earlier to our discussion of the unfortunate dash cam, which got Travis Kalanick recorded. And what that person was actually complaining about was how much money it cost him because he was one of the original black cars. And the original concept in Uber was to have these black town car service, like who's got them and can we get them fast? And so the people who bought them thinking that's what it's going to be, that was a huge investment. It wasn't the, you know, the three-year-old Priuses you see driving around the neighborhoods now.
Yeah, that's right. And it's I'm glad you brought that up because this is a story that I tell in the book and maybe one that's less appreciated, the nuances of it, because the driver, I think, has a reason to be upset, but I don't necessarily think it's Travis that he should be upset with. So, as you say, Uber launched as a luxury car service here in San Francisco and then spread around the country. And it cost quite a bit more than a cab. It was a very expensive service. And it was only until Lyft and another company called Sidecar introduced the notion of ride sharing, or allowing regular people without chauffeur's license to drive their cars and pick anybody up. And this is really 2012, and the state of California looked at it and didn't shut it down. And in fact, Travis at Uber at first thought it was illegal and held back. And when he saw that the Public Utilities Commission in California wasn't going to do anything, he aggressively moved and launched UberX, which we now really know as Uber, all across the country. And if you're a black car driver, particularly if you'd spent a lot of money, what you found is that life wasn't as good. You know, riders would migrate to UberX. There's still plenty of people that use Uber Black. It's a successful service. I occasionally use it if I want to kind of get to the airport and be assured a certain level of experience. But what probably happened to that driver is he made an investment in like a BMW, you know, expensive BMW. His days got a little less busy. Fares came down a little bit because Uber has to keep Uber Black competitive, somewhat competitive, and it becomes a less lucrative pastime. It's hard to see how that's Travis's fault. He was kind of responding to the market and to where regulators were taking it.
Well, it's one of those times when you try version number one, serial number one, and it's like, oh, we're going to make some adjustments here. Unfortunately, it wasn't Travis going back to his original investor saying, golly, we bought 1,000 BMWs, and that was a lot more expensive than the 1,000 Priuses we're now going to buy. It was stuck with the drivers. And,
right.
You know, for me, you want to take out this bad feeling, give them all $5,000 or something.
Well, actually, that's a good point.
That might be a really
good point. Because
good
I think in my technical explanation, I missed something, which is Travis should not have been yelling at his customer. Drivers are their customers, and I think Uber does realize that. And look, I mean, Travis came out right away and said, this was a mistake and I need some leadership help. It's a bad look for the company, particularly in the midst of so much else that's going on. There's a better way to handle it. Maybe it's giving bonuses to drivers. Maybe it's just inviting an angry driver in and saying, we're here to listen to you. You know, sometimes it's as easy as that. You know, I guess he can be a little short-tempered, and he seems to have lost his patience in that recording, and that was a mistake.
Well, Travis also forgot that not only do the clients, you know, say 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 stars, the drivers give the passengers.
Well, he got a 1 review on that.
He got, yeah, ride. If anything, I got a 0. I might have got a 0.
Right.
So, but how many times in the olden days, meaning, you know, over 10 years ago, could a CEO get caught in their own service and be exposed like that? It just couldn't happen. It's a function of this technology we have today. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, certainly. And yeah, and it's empowering. It's empowering for, you know, for the contractors, the workers who are caught up to be able to go and have a venue, a public venue for their discontent. And look, I mean, I think Uber is probably taking driver complaints more seriously now as a result.
And I got to say, Airbnb, it just cracks me up. The reason it was Air is, well, you tell the story.
Yeah. Well, it was originally Airbeds, right?
Yeah. In the founder's apartment because they couldn't afford to pay their rent.
They didn't have guest rooms. The idea was to bring in a couple of guests for a very busy design conference in San Francisco where the local hotels were either booked or too expensive, and they threw down a couple of Airbeds. That was the origin of the name. Now, of course, you know, it has very little to do with Airbeds. In fact, I would wonder if you could even find an Airbed accommodation.
You get a complaint.
Yeah. It seems uncomfortable. You can find castles and beach houses and, you know, palatial apartments in the world's major cities. But the name, the abbreviation of the original name does remain.
In San Francisco, of course, there was legislation and voting, all kinds of things having to do with, well, hey, you know, you can't just be turning this over every night and does, as you were saying earlier, interfere with the neighborhoods. What's the status of local legislation around the world?
It differs from city to city, sometimes country to country. It's basically there's a journey underway that all these different cities are taking to find out what the limit is. Should Airbnb hosts that are not present for a stay be able to open up their homes for 90 days a year, for 60 nights a year? Should they only have one apartment or home for rent on the site? You know, these are every city has to make a different consideration. There are some places like beach towns, beach communities like, you know, down in Orange County that say, we don't want it here. You know, we're a residential community that is already overrun with tourists. Whereas other places, you know, might be more welcome because they don't get a lot of tourist traffic. The other thing that's going on is Airbnb is really being held to account. They need to be a partner with cities in regulating and enforcing some of the laws that are on the books. Early on, Airbnb really didn't think it had a responsibility to do it. You know, they would say, well, we're not the police. These are your laws. And now I think there's an understanding that, you know, the city is not going to employ legions of people to go and comb this internet marketplace to shut down bad actors. Airbnb has to help, and they've been doing that.
Of course, part of every Silicon Valley story, part of every startup story is getting venture capital. And both of these groups, they're talking about introducing a service that is brand new. So you're going in there and the guys are shaking their head, mostly guys shaking their head going, do you really think people are going to, tell us the story of their venture capital experience.
Yeah, I love this because, you know, the venture capitalists are supposed to be the wise men. And yes, mostly men, not all men, but the wise men and women of Silicon Valley, right? They can peer around corners, at least we think. But when these two massive opportunities came to the table in 2010, 2011, most people said no. It seemed odd for a couple of reasons. One, they were asking customers to do something that our parents have told us never to do, get into a stranger's home or get into a stranger's car. That just seemed strange. It was very clear to investors that these would be regulatory fights in a lot of cities. And then, and here's the important point, these CEOs look nothing like the geeky web whizzes or tech geniuses of the past. You know, for all their strengths, Brian and Travis are not Bill Gates or Mark Zuckerberg or Larry Page. They may have technical genius, but they're not technical geniuses, if that makes sense. You know, Brian is a graduate of the Rhode Island School of Design. So the idea of funding a company with a designer as a CEO was very strange, and you know, Airbnb went through all manners of rejection before Sequoia Capital finally invested in them after they came out of the Y Combinator startup school. And Uber had a couple of problems in addition to the ones I just mentioned. One, you know, Travis and Garrett Camp, the co-founders, weren't initially going to be that involved in the company. And so there was this thought that, like, if the founders weren't even running it, why should we invest? And then perhaps the bigger issue is that Travis had a reputation. He was known as being, let's just say, a jerk.
I'm speaking with Bloomberg News editor Brad Stone. His book is The Upstarts, How Uber, Airbnb, and the Killer Companies of the New Silicon Valley Are Changing the World. We'll talk more after a break. Podcasts of Tech Nation and Tech Nation Health are available at iTunes, Stitcher, and other podcast syndication outlets. Coming up in the second half of our show, Tech Nation Health talks about how the data from all those apps and devices is getting connected. And Greer Deal from Global Regulatory Services fills us in on the challenge of getting them approved worldwide. Stay with us. You're listening to Tech Nation. I'm speaking with Brad Stone, Senior Executive Editor of Global Technology at Bloomberg News and author of The Upstarts, How Uber, Airbnb, and the Killer Companies of the New Silicon Valley Are Changing the World.
Uber had a couple of problems in addition to the ones I just mentioned. One, you know, Travis and Garrett Camp, the co-founders, weren't initially going to be that involved in the company. And so there was this thought that, like, if the founders weren't even running it, why should we invest? And then perhaps the bigger issue is that Travis had a reputation. He was known as being, let's just say, a jerk, you know, being tough to deal with, being not always, aligned with his investors in his previous companies. And so there were some investors, and I imagine most of them are kicking themselves, who just took a pass at Uber and now, you know, probably don't like to talk about that much. But I do talk about it in the book and what it says about the world of venture capital, which is, in a way, they're kind of swept up in the same wave we all are. And sometimes it's very hard to see the future, even when it is sitting right across the table from you.
And then you see some of the dogs they invest in sometimes. They're more as embarrassed about that as passing on an Uber.
As long as they have one or two, they're good.
They're good. There are similarities between them. There are differences, as you say. But I was reminded Uber's Travis Kalanick wants to change the way cities work, which is not that different than Steve Jobs wanting to change the world.
I think so. I mean, I think what's happened is, the idealism has moved from the purely digital into the physical, right? That we are now dealing with people and things being manipulated in the real world. And when that happens, the stakes get a lot higher. You know, I talk about this in the book, but there are people that, you know, have unfortunately been in traffic accidents or, tragedies in Airbnbs. And, like, these companies had to be accountable in ways that no other internet marketplace has had to. Like, yeah, eBay, something goes wrong, they give you your money back. If something goes wrong at an Airbnb, you know, you usually have the police involved and the company, you know, has a challenge on its hands. So, but I think you're right in that, like, the idealism that has pervaded earlier generations of entrepreneurs is here too. Uber thinks it can get rid of traffic by carpooling people together or introducing driverless cars. Airbnb's idealism is all around restoring authenticity to travel and, like, matching travelers up with people providing, like, real services in cities.
Hey, I love it because these guys were motivated. We couldn't pay our rent. And it's like there are lots of people out there who couldn't pay their rent or would like to get a little ahead. And, boy, they really like it.
And
both
of these companies, I think, have created new economic opportunities. And I don't think we should be cynical about that.
At the same time, you talk about failures. My personal favorite, of course, is couch surfing.
Yes.
I saw that right from the start.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I said, nah, no, no.
Well, I love how the name, we were talking about the Airbed name there. Like, couch surfing is the same brand promise in a way, right? It's like an uncomfortable night's sleep. They started at the same place. They were much earlier than Airbnb. But we talk about idealism. And, you know, idealism works up to a point. And you have to kind of balance it with some ruthlessness operational discipline, or you're never going to go anywhere. And couch surfing, which, again, you know, it starts seven years before Airbnb had too much idealism. They registered as a nonprofit in the state of New Hampshire. They had employees, like, couch surfing their way around the world. They were all working, kind of virtually. And by the time investors realized that this thing needed to be a real business, it took them forever to transfer over to be a for-profit company. And by then, Airbnb had totally eaten their lunch.
It's tough. Failures are tough. But there's a lot more out there than the big sensations.
I mean, I enjoy talking about the failures in the book because we do criticize the Uber, in particular, to some extent Airbnb, for being too hard-driving, for being jerks, for trampling these regulatory frameworks, for breaking the law. And that criticism is valid, but, you know, these are really old sets of rules with stodgy kind of incumbent industries. And then you look at the failures and you say, well, here's what happened when you weren't such jerks. we know what the outcome is. They never got anywhere. And there were plenty of pre-Ubers, and I tell their stories in the book, companies like Taxi Magic and Cabulous that tried to work within the framework of the taxi industry to play by the rules. And they never got anywhere because you couldn't get those old taxi fleets to change and embrace new technology.
Airbnb this last August, on one night, had 1.8 million people booked, their best night ever. Millions of rides daily with Uber worldwide. These models create revenues. They create jobs. How do we take these business models into the future and into other areas?
Well, it's interesting because there has been this proliferation of other businesses that are trying to use these kind of business models and to do other things with like little pockets of success, grocery delivery, errand delivery. You know, there's like Uber for laundry and Uber for babysitting. You know, none of it's made an impact in the way that the original has. What's interesting is that all these transactions are sort of, you know, the prices of the service are low, and it'll be interesting to see when we kind of move upstream and when it's, you know, when the same thinking pervades like real estate. When can we do a transaction more virtually or without the agent, or healthcare? You know, are there ways to, you know, send doctors to patients instead of, you know, vice versa, you know, evading the kind of long way to doctor's offices? Yeah, I think there's an opportunity there. You know, we'll see. Maybe it's just that transportation and lodging, you know, and travel are these massive industries that have, you know, that really haven't changed in a long time. And so that they are just kind of ripe for disruption in a way that some other industries aren't. I guarantee you everything right now is being tried because the opportunity is so big.
Well, Brad, thanks so much for joining me. Please come back. Don't be a stranger.
Thank you, Moira.
My guest today is Bloomberg News Senior Executive Editor of Global Technology, Brad Stone. His book is The Upstarts, How Uber, Airbnb, and the Killer Companies of the New Silicon Valley Are Changing the World. It's published by Little Brown. I'm Moira Gunn. You're listening to Tech Nation. Welcome to Tech Nation Health, reimagining the future of health and healthcare with the emergence of new technologies. Today we talk about integrating the information from all our smartphone apps and exercise bands, right up to all the medical devices, and doing clinical trials remotely. Drew Schiller, the CEO of Validic, explains it. Then we remember that every nation's regulations can be different, from drugs and biomedical devices to cosmetics. Greer Deal, the director of the advisory firm Global Regulatory Services, gives us the global view. First up is Drew Schiller from Validic. Familiar to everyone are the apps and fitness devices in our lives, from our smartphones to wristbands and watches we slap on our wrists. Unfortunately, they don't speak to each other, and that's only the beginning.
We started in the wellness space, actually, in the corporate wellness space, where what we saw was a number of wellness vendors. These are companies like Limeade or ShapeUp or Virgin Pulse, who allow self-insured employers to help engage their employee base and keep them healthier. What was happening was that the employees started to use these apps on their phone or the wearable devices instead of the web-based programs that these vendors were providing. So what we were doing is we enabled actually initially just about 25 device connections to, you know, Fitbits and Runkeeper and a few other apps and devices. And that greatly enabled them to accelerate their platform and reach more of the employees. Very, very quickly, we gained interest from health systems, from pharmaceutical companies, from all these other folks in healthcare saying, wait a minute, you can actually access that data. That's really interesting to us. So it was actually something that we backed into almost to becoming a healthcare company.
It wasn't your original idea, but
no,
okay, we'll go with it.
Yeah, but it's been great. And so as we've expanded our portfolio to include the FDA-listed devices, like the glucose meters, the pulse oximeters, the blood pressure monitors, we've really started to see that the overlap and the intersection between you can actually have a consumer wearable tracker and an FDA-listed device working on the same person, and that actually gives you a much more holistic view of what's happening in that patient's life.
Now, how does this work for someone who is developing a new device? Do they knock on your door? How does that work?
Yeah, so very frequently,
knock
actually.
Knock on your digital door?
That's right, yeah. We, through our investors and other venture connections that we have in the industry, a lot of early stage companies will network to us and ask us, even at the development stage, what's new, what's going on, what should we be thinking about as they're making design considerations. And then certainly when they launch a device, Validic is a real natural platform for actually getting that through. We love our startup partners. We actually have a product called Validic Connect that allows them to send data directly to us from their device, so that it can be accessible to our myriad healthcare customers, you know, like Kaiser Permanente or Cerner, and you know, a lot of the biggest of the bigs in healthcare use our services. And so this enables them to focus on really providing the best consumer user experience, and then allowing Validic to actually help deliver that data to where it needs to go.
You know, the value of any of these devices, you know, they have to be on people. The data has to be able to get out. But with this kind of a connection, not only are they able to, you know, sell their devices, but their information goes so far, they'd never be able to make connections with all the other device manufacturers and all the big players. It's just not possible.
Yeah, that's right. And in fact, you know, when we first started, we knew we were providing a really valuable service to the healthcare companies, because we're enabling them to build one connection and have a myriad of choices of devices and not have to worry about what's going to happen in the market in the future. It's kind of future-proofing their own decision-making process. What we've learned over the years is that we also are providing a huge value to the device manufacturers, in that they are experts at consumer engagement and at building a really beautiful device that consumers want to use to manage a condition. However, they're not enterprise services or service organizations that want to support large business development efforts with thousands of healthcare companies and, you know, working with doctors, calling them.
And programs and you name it.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. So Validic really provides value to both sides of the ecosystem in that way.
Certainly one thing that is top of mind these days is security and privacy, especially consider, wait a minute, this is information about my body. This is information about me. Who knows it? Who's going to know it? How do you deal with that?
Yeah, that's a really great question. It's an important one as well. So what's important to understand about Validic is that we operate behind the scenes as an intermediary. And so the relationship and ultimately the ownership of where the data goes is with the healthcare provider, and the consumer will enter through the healthcare provider to connect their devices. And then the consumer device or the medical device company will obviously have access to the patient's data, because they have to collect that data. As that data flows through Validic system, it's de-identified. So I don't actually know who that patient is. I don't know who you, Moira, are from anyone else. But additionally, what happens with your data, that data is expressly permissioned for the use by that health system for a specific purpose. And so we keep a very clean path there for around privacy and security.
I'm sure the people who focus on making money say, you're cutting off revenue streams. And it's like, you're saying that we don't want to do that.
Well, right. I mean, ultimately, how big is your revenue stream going to be if you have lost the trust of the people, right? And so I think that's really important. And, you know, one thing that I do encourage every consumer to look at is, what is the data that these companies actually have on you? Because really, it's data that could be valuable in many other ways, and it's not actually data that is necessarily important to your particular privacy. So what I mean is that, you know, if you have a consumer wearable device and it tracks your steps and maybe your heart rate and your sleep, in aggregate, in a de-identified aggregate stage, your information could actually be really valuable at detecting some interesting patterns. So, for example, you know, maybe it could be that in the city of San Francisco, in the second week of January every year, the average person gets 1.5 hours fewer sleep than any other time of the year. That's an interesting thing for people to say, well, what is going on in San Francisco at that point in time? Maybe there's something that we should be concerned about, right? And so that's just a crazy example. But the data could be useful in other ways. And I think that consumers, by and large, if they think through how the data could be used in that way, then they'd probably be a little less concerned, because it's we're not talking about, you know, pairing sleep information with credit card information with, you know, anything else. Like, we're really just talking about aggregate de-identified data and looking at how trends might be changing something in the public way.
You did mention that some of this is about clinical studies. What people really frequently don't understand is when we get a lot of subjects in for a clinical study for a drug, as an example, they keep having to come in to a doctor or a nurse practitioner, and they will, you know, have a lot of data recorded then, and they'll take their notebooks they've written things down in. And it's so much easier if they just have devices which are recording, and it's cheaper, and it's more accurate.
Yeah.
So this kind of thing could really change how we do these clinical trials, as well as the cost. They've got to be cheaper.
I totally agree. And you know, in fact, so one of the in the clinical trial space, one of the things I like to talk about is that the wearable device in particular allows you to passively actively participate, right? Because all you have to do is put it on, and you're going to be collecting much better data than you would have on your actigraphy based on a survey that you were to fill out later at the end of the day, right? And so alongside that, there was recently a study called the Brighton study out of the University of Washington, where they were looking at, could we run a mobile-based study, like a cell phone-based study using a cell phone and some other devices only for depression? It's the first ever study of its kind for mental health, the entirely mobile-based study. Their goal was to get 150 patients, participants in this study. And they used, you know, traditional stuff like bus ads and posters. And then they also used social media to get people on board. They actually got a full complement of 150 subjects within the first week. And so they applied for additional funding, and they actually ended up getting over 2,900 people registered for this around the country. So it allowed them to be multi-site because they didn't have to come in for a visit. And so
They shipped them the device?
They could just use an app on their phone.
Oh, use an app on their phone?
Yeah, they could just use an app on their phone. And we're seeing this with ResearchKit too, through Apple's initiative, is that this allows you to reach so many more people so much more effectively and efficiently. It changes the study a bit, because there's different information that you can get when it's in the hands of a person on a day-to-day basis versus coming in into a clinic and getting a blood draw, right? It changes the information, but the information that you get is generally much more robust, and you can get it from a much larger sample size, which makes the data more statistically significant.
Science is changing.
Yeah, that's right.
I like it.
What I think we're going to see in the future is, rather than scientists hypothesizing questions and then running a very expensive multi-year study to see if that worked or not, I think we're going to actually see scientists looking at the data to understand where the next study should be, or even looking at the data to find results that have already been discovered, but they haven't been raised up yet.
According to some purists, that means that they can look at the data and then they have to create a new hypothesis and test separately. But we'll let them argue about that at a later date.
That's right.
Thanks for coming in. Please come back. Keep us updated. We want to hear.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Maura.
Drew Schiller is the co-founder and CEO of Validic. More information is available at validic.com. That's valid, I-C, validic.com. Normally, I speak with guests about developing new drugs or biomedical devices, both of which need to be cleared with government regulatory approvals. But how do you know what regulations you need where and when? Greer Deal is the director of the advisory firm Global Regulatory Services.
Indeed. So the services that we provide are what are known as regulatory affairs. In brief, that's dealing with the rules and regulations to do with medical products. So any medical product, any life science product, which ranges from foods to stem cells and regenerative medicine, you have to comply with certain regulations in order to get that product onto the market and to be able to market it safely. And that's throughout the world. So that's what we cover.
How different is it in from the UK and Europe to the US to China to you name it? I don't know how global you are.
It's incredibly different. We get so many clients from the US who think that, you know, because they're already compliant with the regulations here in the US, that that will readily translate over into Europe. And I'm sorry, but it doesn't.
No, we're just going to get in a plane and go. Don't you worry about a thing.
And the same goes for the other way. You know, European regulations don't necessarily translate readily into the US.
For example?
So orphan drugs, in the US, it's quite a quick process. So it can take like about 2-3 months, and it's very straightforward, very simple. Whereas in Europe, you're talking 6, 9, 12 months to get through and get that orphan drug approved. So that orphan drug designation. And we require so much more data than the US, which is interesting because often it's the US that actually requires more data than Europe. So, yeah. With regards to China and places like India, their regulatory systems are very young at the moment. And so they're keeping an eye on the US and Europe and hopefully adopting the best of both countries in order to, you know, help companies who want to launch their products into those particular territories. But it does mean that there's constant change. And that's the one thing that we can guarantee in regulatory is change.
We're regulating this so it'll stay the same, but it constantly changes.
It constantly changes, yes. So that's why, you know, it's very important to engage with consultancies who are right up to speed, up to date with what's going on in these territories. And we have this fantastic team of consultants, professionals all around the world who have that on the ground, country-specific knowledge to help our clients. So we, you know, we're halfway there with those people already in those particular countries because they're engaging with the regulatory agency on a day-to-day basis. So they're up to speed with what's changing, you know, what's going out, what's coming in. So, you know, we're very much there with our finger on the button.
It's one thing to sit in one place and say, let me tell you about over there.
Yes.
But the where the rubber meets the road, as we say, is like they've got to be over there and make it happen.
Yes.
So how did you solve the fact that you have to have people in all of these places? And you have.
Well, we started out just over 9 years ago, and my background is being in the life sciences for most of my career. And we identified very early on that, you know, life science companies work in a global economy. It sounds crazy to say that now, but 9 years ago, it was a bit, you know, everyone thought US, Europe, they're the key markets, and they still are. But no one thought of anywhere else. And we realized fairly early on that actually people are going to start being interested in places like China, Australia, Japan, Korea. And to get that, you know, really good support, you need that on-the-ground knowledge. I had direct experience of that from working with a previous consultancy. So, you know, where the client came along and said, I want US, Europe, can you help me? Yes, we can help you. And then later on they said, well, actually now I want to launch in Japan. And they said, sorry, can't help you. So that client then walks away, which is crazy. You know, you've already got a good working relationship with that client and they trust you. So we wanted to be able to build that network around the world of these professionals who have that country-specific knowledge, have that good working relationship with the agency, and of course can speak the language, which is a huge barrier at times.
We've got to speak, in every place, they've got to speak the science language,
yes,
the regulatory language, and the actual language of the people,
yes,
there.
It helps.
It helps a lot.
Yeah. So the first 2 years of our business, we actually focused on getting together this network of professionals. And if we had a client, that was a bonus, but we wanted to get our foundations down for the business, you know, good solid foundations so that we could grow and develop from there and be able to offer that, you know, full service to our clients.
Now, I have to say, most people know that the FDA covers drugs.
Yes.
The FDA covers biomedical devices. But a lot of people don't realize they also cover cosmetics, as do all the countries in the world. And you handle those as well.
We do, yes. And in March this year, we actually launched a subsidiary to Global Regulatory Services. And that's called Creme de la Creme, so the best of the best. And that is purely to focus on the cosmetic industry, mainly to do with European regulations where we can offer the role of responsible person. And that means we're actually legally liable to make sure that clients' products are compliant with the EU regulation. But also we are helping elsewhere around the world. So we can help European companies launch into, say, the US and India, China, Korea, if needed. But our core focus for Crème de la Crème is the European market.
What kind of regulations are there in cosmetics?
In Europe, there's just one EU regulation, which came out in 2011. Before that, there were directives, which meant that each country in Europe could interpret that directive in their own way. So now it is more or less properly harmonized with having the single regulation. And that's about labeling. So you have to make sure that there's certain data on the labeling. It has to be in the right font size. It even has to be on the right side of the packaging. So we can help with all of that. And crucially, it's down to claims. So quite often, companies want to say that it can...
Wrinkles be gone.
I know, wrinkles be gone, yes. But if you say it in a certain way, you start going into the borderline area of it actually being a medicine. So this is where we have to be very, very careful. So clients always want to push the boundaries. Often they're like naughty children. They want to push, push, push. And then we say, well, actually, no, the market's not going to accept that. And the regulation definitely says no. So then we have to reel them back in again and have a bit of a reality check. And so we help them with the claims and make sure that they comply with that particular regulation.
Well, you said the magic word, harmonize. And we are always talking about harmonizing all of these regulations in various countries and regions. In these last 9 years, have things become more harmonized or less harmonized?
Now, that's a very interesting question. I would say, on the whole, it's more harmonized. But if you look at Europe as a specific example, there are some member states, some countries, which just have to have their own individual stamp. So there will be some little nuance that
we can guess which countries. No. We won't.
I won't name any of them. They might get embarrassed.
So every little tweak here, a little tweak there.
Yes. And a very good example is actually the medical device directives. The text has been finalized now for a regulation. And because it's a regulation, it's then harmonized across Europe. So the goal is that all the member states have now interpreted the regulation in the same way. Again, there will be slight differences in some of the member states, but that's been harmonized now. That should come into full force early next year. And that's going to have a huge impact on the medtech industry, actually.
Well, Greer, it's been a pleasure. Don't be a stranger. Come back. See us anytime.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. I love San Francisco.
Greer Deal is the Director of Global Regulatory Services. More information is available at globalregulatoryservices.com. For Tech Nation Health, I'm Moira Gunn.
Tech Nation and its regular segment Biotech Nation are produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Executive producer is Matt Gardner. The director of technical production is Monte Carlos, and audio engineers include Howard Gelman, Seal Mahler, and Larry Upton. Our theme music was composed by Ann Nachtrieb-Zesiger and Robert Powell, with title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. Program information and internet audio is available on the web at technation.com. Tech Nation and Biotech Nation are productions of Tech Nation Media. I'm Paul Lancourt.